afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Well, today is May 10th. It is Mother's Day all day. So, happy Mother's Day to all the moms. We know that's a job. It's a job, and for all the people that are, I've had people say I'm just a mom. It's like, oh, well, yeah, that's a whole job all by itself. So, Bill, got anything to add?
Being a mom is a job all by itself.
Oh, man. You're fired.
Okay.
Bill's fired. So we've got Mike Ariza on with us today because we are updating. Let's see. This would be part 8, I think. Now that seems not enough parts, but it's 8 or 9. I'll have to double check. Of our gas situation, the California gas situation, that does affect everyone else. Why? Why does it affect everyone else, Bill?
Because they might want to come to California and buy gas.
National security. Come on.
Oh, yeah, national security. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Today is Stump Bill Day. It's no longer Mother's Day. Today is Ask Bill Questions He's Not Ready For. Ah, poor Bill. Wife is horrible. I feel sorry for him being married to whoever that is. Yeah. She must be a monster. Oh, man. So there is a 2-page paper on here, California Gasoline Supply Outlook, a Disaster in the Making, written on April 15th, 2026 by Professor Michael Michet, that we have interviewed bunches of times. And also James Rector, who is a professor at Berkeley. So these guys put together a 2-page overview, and we thought it would be worth highlighting and also doing a little more focus on the refinery, just refinery stuff. We always do a lot of facts and figures and math and all that stuff, but I don't think people really understand how tricky it will be if we do lose our refineries. Meanwhile, we have Tom Steyer running for governor in California, who's running around telling everyone he beat big oil and, you know, punished them or whatever the heck he was doing. And so obviously.
Yeah, that's working out. That's working out well.
Obviously he's part of the problem.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. So Mike is maybe in there, maybe not in there. Yeah. Hey, there you are. So, you're a U.S. Navy veteran. Thanks for that, Mike.
And thank you.
You were at the Chevron oil refinery as an operator, Exxon Valero in Benicia as a senior refinery technician, Flying J, and now you're at Chico State making the campus run, like all of it.
That's what they tell me.
That's the rumor.
That's the rumor.
So I thought I would let you give a little bit more of your bio as we go through this, just because I know we're going to talk about refinery. I didn't know if you wanted to start with the paper or that, or how you wanted to kind of go about this today.
I'm not really sure. I think you just kind of brought up Professor Michet and Rector's paper they published on the 15th. Basically, as you know, we've been kind of working together, me and Professor Michet and Assemblyman Ellis, for, 10 months now. And we saw this coming. We published our initial 10-page brief about military force readiness back in October. That was the 21st, asking for the Defense Production Act to be invoked under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution based on what the three of us saw with our... You know, between the three of us, we have, as professor said, we have about 120 years of experience between the three of us. And the professor is like the research guy. Stan, as you heard last week, is definitely the scientist. And then I'm the practitioner. I literally flew the plane. The disaster, the looming disaster potential we saw coming, caused us to write that brief on October 21st that was published in Washington, D.C. Strangely enough, as I've been researching Andy Waltz, the CEO of Chevron, about a month and a half before then, was talking about how the refineries have been treated, how the oil corporations have been treated by the state. And back on September 5th, he actually said, I think that we are already at that crisis mode. So he was seen with the shutdown, the conversion of the two refineries to diesel, renewable diesel, and then the pending shutdowns of Wilmington and Valero. He saw, you know, he saw the disaster coming. So he was making these quotes. September, October, we published our brief. October, I think it was 17th, Wilmington shut down. Right around the same time, Valero and Benicia canceled their contracts, their oil contracts, crude oil contracts. At that point, we kind of figured that Valero was going to start reducing its rates because it was going to run, it wanted to run off all the intermediate tanks because unlike a normal turnaround maintenance period that a refinery goes through, they were going for a permanent shutdown, which means they have to get all their tanks emptied, everything, you know, cleaned up so they can basically leave everything in a mothball state. So they started reducing rates. One evidence of that was we were seeing imports of jet fuel from South Korea. They started going up. And when Valero reduces its crude oil rates, its jet fuel production proportionally drops off. Also, based on that, we kind of figured that they were going to shut down around January, though they were announcing April, but that they would actually pull crude oil out of the refinery on January, and that's what they did. So, you know, we had that spot on, and then prices started going up when Valero went down long before, well, let's see, January 31st. February 28th, the Iranian war started. So, it, you know, up where we live, Reading and Chico, gasoline prices are already up about 80 cents a gallon. They started climbing about a week after Valero pulled the plug. Of course, the media keeps reporting they're going down in April. You know, it's fine, but they actually went down January 31st. And then this letter, I was giving the professor a call, this two-page document, but I was curious because I know that you know, we heard in the town hall that South Korea stopped shipping his jet fuel. In the town hall, he got a text from somebody.
Yeah, and that was, what was
April 2nd.
Yeah, okay.
So you go April 2nd, and I was calling him because I knew that they had stopped, all the Asian refineries had stopped sending us gasoline, jet, and diesel, China, India, South Korea, and Singapore. So I was kind of say, Professor, you know, I was going to call him again. You guys had a chance to look at the numbers, and at the same time, he sent that document to me when I was trying to call him. So that right now, that document to me is a template. We're kind of on page, we're on paragraph 4, going past paragraph 5. If we want to, let's see, I can pull that up. Let's see. So I'm on our website here. Let's see. So if you go to paragraph 4 for folks that are listening, he says, okay, the full effect is yet to come. Okay, alarmingly, dramatic reductions in gasoline and crude imports have yet to hit California's physical supply. Now, keep in mind, folks, that this letter was dated April 15th. We're now well into May. He says, California depends heavily on the CARB-compliant gasoline from refineries in Asia, which provide nearly all of California gasoline imports, which is actually 40% of the overall gasoline supply for the state. These Asian refiners, notably, he notes in here, India and South Korea, but there's also Singapore. China doesn't supply us with gasoline. I don't think it is diesel, but they shut those off. But he notes that they curtailed their exports around March 15th. But the corresponding decline in the arrivals to California has only just begun due to the shipping times, 25 to 45 days coming across the ocean. So over the next 1 or 2 weeks, our gasoline imports are expected to drop off sharply, and that's what's going on now. That's why now they're starting, the media is finally starting, oh, we got 4, maybe 6 weeks of gasoline supply left. You know, they're starting to report these things finally. He says gasoline imports are expected to drop off sharply, which reflects cargoes that were never loaded or diverted. And this will mark the point at which the import shock becomes fully visible in terminal supply, and ultimately it's going to hit us at the gas pump, not just in our prices, but in, as you go in farther in his document, he's talking about shortages, which is spot on. That is going to happen. Very, very likely now that's going to happen. Same thing with crude oil. We're the only state in the country that imports any amount of crude oil from the Middle East. It's instead of producing our own, we've all, me and you and Stan, we've all discussed this many times, of how much, you know, we had the fifth largest reserves in the country, and we used to produce our own, then we had the refineries, which would refine our own products. So now, not only, if you take a look, it's interesting, if you look at this marine traffic.com, it shows all the different ships all over the world. You can look at the Pacific right now, and there's nothing coming our way, which is not good.
Yeah, that's actually good. Super not good.
Yeah.
So with nothing, do we think all of it has docked or no?
I looked at it. There are a couple ships still docked, one or two ships hanging out. I didn't see maybe one or two ships down in L.A. They list them as chemical oils or oil products tankers. Almost every ship that's in the Bay Area or down in L.A. Long Beach is a crude oil tanker. So there's very few ships now. They've probably been offloaded or nearly offloaded. And what he's talking about is there's nothing coming behind them, because when the and this is a vulnerability, Aaron. Bill, this is a vulnerability. All of us have talked about, the five of us, where we talked about, if you have a problem at the Port of Los Angeles, or you have right now, God forbid, we have another refinery go down, unscheduled downtime right now. Even storms at sea, holding ships up. Well, another thing the professor mentioned was some type of global conflict. Well, we have it now. We have that global conflict. And all of those refineries in Asia, they supply us with gasoline, jet, and diesel. Because they get all their crude oil through the Strait of Hormuz, they had to cut their rates back. And it gets down to something really simple on logistics. It's like Andy Waltz is saying, if you have a Chevron refinery in South Korea, and you have to cut way back, you can't run South Korea dry. The home nation that you're in, you got to cut off whatever you're exporting, you got to cut off. And that's basically what they had to do, because they are running out of crude oil. So we left ourselves totally vulnerable. We went from totally energy dominant, which California used to be, to energy dependent. And we saw this as a strong possibility of what was to come. Again, when Valero went down, we already started to see the prices go up because we couldn't offload enough fuel. Now, the situation we're in with that, and then with some of our crude oil being cut, because we have been importing crude oil from the Middle East ourselves, just in this state, we're in trouble. And his document just kind of, that document just kind of lays it out. So, I saw prices increase in Chico and Hamilton City about like a week and a half ago. I was going out to the farm and coming back. I suddenly saw the prices jumping again. So that told me that we've hit that critical point now where the ships are not coming anymore, and we're starting to feel that supply shock. So basically 40% of our fuel that was coming in is not coming in anymore.
So probably the first places that are going to get hit with shortages are the rural areas, because they're not going to want the big cities to run out of gas. So the rural communities will be the ones that are probably going to be the first to be affected. Would you agree with that?
Maybe. They have their contracts, Bill. I'm not. It's more of the downstream. I think you get into rationing, even back in the 70s, it didn't matter where you are. It was rationing, odd, even all that stuff.
Right.
And the thing is, now we can't pull ourselves out of it. We don't have, back in the, we talked about this before too, back in the 70s, we had the ability to refine the crude oil. It was a crude oil shortage, not a product shortage.
Right now, it's true.
A product shortage. So we don't have the refineries. The refineries aren't there. That's the problem. They don't, like news media and different people that know, they don't really think about, that I hear, they don't think about the fact that Rodeo and Marathon and Martinez went on renewable diesel. That basically took 350,000 barrels a day of crude oil refining capability, took it offline. So that means the gasoline they were making, the jet fuel they were making, and that's why I say 40% imported, because you took around 18 to 20% of the gasoline run offline in 2023 when those refineries converted to renewable diesel. They were effectively no longer crude oil refineries. Then Wilmington went down. That was another 8 to 9%. And then Valero, which nobody realizes, Valero is a big gasoline producer percentage-wise of crude. If you look at the percentage of crude oil converted to gasoline in your typical refinery, You can look it up. It'll be like 50-55%, you know, on the high end. Well, Valero, it's like 70%. So the crude oil that they actually convert to gasoline. They don't make extra jet fuel and extra diesel. They make extra gasoline. So the gasoline hit, that's why I say, you know, Valero's like 12%. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, 2-3%, whatever, bottom line is we're importing about 40% of our fuel, and now that's gone. That's why the professor put that document, a crisis in the making. I mean, that title is very appropriate. It is literally a crisis.
Mic drop.
have we increased oil production since all this started?
Okay, boys, hold on. We have to take a really quick break. Then when we come back, we'll talk about that. So you're listening to We the People. It's May the 10th. This is the ninth different program of the programs we've done on the oil and gas issue. And the paper that we keep referencing, California Gasoline Supply Outlook, that is on the page for today on May the 10th. You can print it off yourself or just read it online. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much.
Doing bad things to you. The official theme song of the California State Legislature.
No doubt. Sometimes I feel so sorry for Sam.
At least the supermajority. The rest of the people are just trapped and along for the ride. And for all those of you that are thinking that you might not vote here on June 2nd in the state of California, I hope someone slaps you right now. Just a big slap coming from us. Yes, it makes a huge difference. And the only reason, you know, funny, people complain about the people in office, but hard reality, they're not electing each other and they don't elect themselves. So who really is to blame? So anyway, so Mike, Bill, you had a question on the way out.
Yeah.
On the way, cut you off at the pass.
Have we increased oil production since this has been brought to light?
Yeah, you know, the professor and his colleague Jamie Rector, they wrote a thing on crude oil production back in December, I think, and the professor just wrote an updated one that I'll shoot to you. But yes, remember they invoked the Defense Production Act to restart the Sable offshore platforms, Hondo, Heritage, and Harmony on the Outer Continental Shelf on Santa Barbara. So mm-hmm. That's cranking up to 50,000 barrels a day. And then you got these, you know, I'm not a politician, so I'm going to call these people. The state suing them, the Becerra, whoever it is, Bonta, whoever it is. These people are sick in the head. They're sick in the head. This state is in a crisis. I mean, you know, go away from running out, shortages. People are suffering right now.
They're suing them to stop the oil production. There's something not operating on all thrusters. Yeah.
The pain that their policies have inflicted on the state, and here's the president and Secretary Wright trying to do something positive to help the situation out, is to get us off the crude oil dependency. It's going to take a lot more than that to get us off the fuel, the product dependency. But, you know, these guys, they're, they, I don't know, Aaron. It just, and Bill, it just kind of blows me away. You know, I was driving back from my grandson's track meet in Folsom yesterday, and I come up to this, I think it's called Wheatland. Regular unleaded, $6.59, $6.79 for premium, or for mid-grade, and then super unleaded was $6.90. And the thing that caught my eye was red dye diesel, $7.34 a gallon. Back in December, it was like $2.60. So you're killing the farmers. You're absolutely killing the farmers.
Yeah, there's not a huge advantage of red dye diesel anymore.
Well, no, and that's the thing. That was to help farmers and where they could make a reasonable profit for their work. You know, their fertilizers, all that stuff. I'm kind of divesting a little bit here, but they're digressing. But, you know, their fertilizers. I had one farmer say they're just tearing their contract up. They can't afford their fertilizer. Debbie and her small, you know, her small 10-acre farm, her fertilizer last year was like 680. It's now 1,590 for the same amount of fertilizer, the same fertilizer. It's like 2.5 times the price. And you got these big farmers where they're, you know, they're fertilizing, you know, hundreds or thousands of acres. You know, they buy 1,000 gallons of, diesel. It was $2,600, $2,700 in December. Now it's $6,000, $6,500. You know, the farmers don't work on a big margin here of profit here. Their margins a lot of times are very slim when you take into labor and their equipment costs and energy and electricity and all the other things, health care, you know, all the things that they have to pay for. They're not working for some company like Exxon or Chevron where all this stuff's covered for them. They have to take care of themselves. So their margins are real low. And just, it's killing them. It's really killing the farmers. And then just everybody else. I mean, you know, just common sense.
Well, and all that is baked into the...
I'm not rich.
Yeah, that's all baked into the price of goods and services.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't just hit the producer.
Across the board, yes, all the way to transportation and stuff in the store. I mean, I'm surprised we haven't heard a lot of people complain. I've noticed prices going up in the store.
Yeah. Well, the sad part is we're putting ourselves in a position that, you know, people, we've said this a million times, but, you know, people are real quick to blame the war in Iran. And the thing is, we could have been unaffected by that. We had the ability in California to be self-sustaining and be insulated from that.
But yes, it's, you know, I go back on that to, like, the professor was talking about. He's really, obviously, really good with statistics and all that, but he's also good, you know, he looks into the history of things really well. He was talking about how we supplied both fronts of World War II with fuel, and we took care of our state. Now we can't even take care of our own state, and it's not even close. And you know, you had us warning about it. You had the CEOs warning about it. I mean, we got these three letters out from these three companies, including Chevron. If we're not for the policies of Newsom and especially his rogue air board, if we're not for their policies, we would not be very affected at all from the war. And the ironic part is not only would we be not affected, we could actually be selling fuel to Australia and New Zealand, to some of those countries. We could be helping them right now.
Yeah, we can't help ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cut our nose off to spite our face to have better air so we could buy oil and gas from gross polluters, because that makes perfect sense to no one. You know, we've mentioned it, but we've never really gone into the whole idea of these turnarounds that the refineries have to do. And we've talked a little bit about the cost and all that, but we should probably peel that apart a little bit more, because that's a huge factor with 7 refineries remaining in the state of California and the only other option bringing fuel from outside the country, you know. And six of the 7 have said, and those letters are on the page, the front page of the site there under our tab at gascrisis.org, so you can go read them. So that's 2 refineries each for PBF, Marathon, and Chevron, and they've all said, change your policy or we're going to leave. If any of these guys have a turnaround coming, that's millions and millions of dollars. Why would they do that if they're just going to get run out of the state?
Well, that's the thing they're looking at. You know, it's untenable and unsustainable. And we're talking the maintenance periods that they go through, they'll make improvements. They'll do stuff to increase refinery throughput. I know Valero, actually Exxon, right before Valero, spent over $1 billion on one maintenance turnaround period. It's where the refinery shuts down. There's a lot of coordination involved. A lot of the workforce jumps from, like in Valero, there's about 400 personnel total, and your workforce jumps to like 3,000 people that are in the refinery to do this turnaround. You're bringing in equipment, bringing in catalysts, bringing in these huge cranes. One tower they lifted, the crude oil vacuum tower, that was a 1 million pound lift.
Wow.
Those cranes are not cheap. Mm-hmm. Those are real expensive, and they have to, there's maintenance that they have to do. There's like boiler inspections they have to do by law. There's also like on the coker, sulfur units, different units, there's things that they look at, they inspect. They know where problem areas are, you know, that where problems can develop just from, you know, they have decades and decades and decades of history. So, you know, they're all looking at inspection. I remember one time they looked at some overhead, they're called fin fans, those huge fin fans on one tower, and they inspected it, and the day shift guy was kind of, you know, the day shift inspector was looking at it, and he had some concerns about it. So during the nighttime, when we came back in on the next day shift, there was a tag hanging on those fin fans that said condemned. So the night shift inspector said, no, we're not coming back up with this. And this was two big, huge tubed fin fans, and they were stainless steel. So they had to have those manufactured. I mean, the money to do that is just, you're talking incredible amounts of money. So, yes, they have to shut down. They want, when they come back up, they want to know they're gonna get a reasonable return on their, you know, ROCI, return on their capital invested. And in this state, it doesn't happen. That's why they're looking at this. Now you're doing this cap and trade. You're throwing this at us. You're wanting Chevron to pay out maybe another $500 million. PBF, which of the three, PBF is the smallest of the three by far. And they're in the paper on the on our domain, they're showing their increases, their cost going up by 400% to like $340 million or something like that. So, and then they're going to spend, you know, $300, $400, $500 million on a turnaround, a shutdown maintenance period. They're not going to do that. And I'm really worried because I was talking with the professor about last week, and he said, well, they're just the state's just throwing them a bone. You know, they're not taking this seriously because, and the thing is, what's really concerning to me is these people and their total blindness, because they tried to do that with Valero. Remember, they took Valero, Valero went to the state capitol somewhere around the end of November, and the state said, hey, we'll give you, you know, we got like $250 million we'll give you, can you stay open? And Valero told them to pack sand. Said, no, we're leaving. We're going to take our $1.1 billion loss. You keep your $280 million, whatever it was. You keep your money. We're leaving. We're done with you. We are not going to deal with this anymore. This is the thing. You know, they tried to throw, what you think they would pay attention to this and learn. These companies are serious. It's like Andy Waltz. I've seen him on a couple different, you know, where he's talking. And they don't want to leave. Andy Waltz and those CEOs at Marathon and PBF, they know what will happen to our state if they shut down and leave. They know. That's why, you know, if Andy Waltz, like, you know, we got to look at, you know, what we're doing with our money. We, you know, back in September, he was saying, well, I'm not saying, you know, we're going to go or we're going to stay. I mean, we don't want to go. We understand what's going on. You know, that's why when they moved their headquarters, they didn't just start shutting down their refineries. But, you know, like he said, the state's been at war with them for about the last 10 or 15 years, and it just gets to where it doesn't pencil out anymore. They have that fiduciary responsibility to all their shareholders. They have to make somewhat of it. It doesn't have to be a copious profit, but at least a decent profit. But instead, they're hemorrhaging money, and then they got to spend money on things like turnarounds. They're getting fined, egregiously fined. I mean, they even fined Budweiser $2 million in the close. The air district, the same air district that fined Valero. They fined Budweiser some $2 million in the close. they're finding them as they're leaving.
Yeah, huge incentive to do business here.
Yeah. Thanks, here, by the way. Goodbye.
Well, and with that kind of cost to do these upgrades and all of that, you can't sink that kind of money in if you're going to get run out on a rail.
Well, if you're not going to make money, you're getting railroaded, which is exactly what they've been doing. Calero spent, I think Keith Washington told me it was like $650 million on equipment for abating the SO2, sulfur dioxide and particulate matter out the main concrete stack. So they put in like $650 million worth of equipment for a wet gas scrubber, MEA scrubbing system, steam generator, and they replaced the crude unit furnaces with brand new ones. And then, you know, here they are later getting fined $82 million for the unit that makes hydrogen and carbon dioxide. And that was between that and the gasoline holdup where they had to build tankage or hold more storage up and build more tanks. That's when San Antonio just said, we're done. And no, you keep your $200 million, we're done with you guys. It's not happening anymore. So that's the, you know, it's unprecedented in history. I don't think any corporations have ever joined together like this. And they're all saying the exact same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, when you read the letters from them, they're all saying the same thing. And I know that most people don't really realize that we can't just, you know, get fuel from Texas or somewhere, you know, that we don't have any pipelines that come into this state. It just
because we never needed them.
Right. But we don't have them. And there's no way you're going to build them to fix this problem in a timely fashion. And the president can't run in and make companies produce fuel. Doesn't really work that way. They can change the regulatory environment, but only briefly if the state doesn't agree. So bottom line is California governor's race this year is probably the most important thing on the ballot for every single person who lives in the state.
Oh, yeah. He's got to do something. Hilton or Mr. Bianco, they got to do something with this damn air board.
Yeah, you're not going to...
And the air districts, Bay Area Air Quality Management District, all these different San Joaquin Valley Air District, all these different air districts, they got to go through and just clean house. I'm sorry. It's just you can't run the state like this.
Well, they, we're not going to be out of a Democrat supermajority, in one election, but I do think a change at the top.
Well, he could do executive orders, which everybody knows could be turned around with the next administration. But if he implements executive orders and they really turn things around and make things work, wouldn't they have a harder time going back and saying, hey, we're...
Well, you dismantle the agencies.
Yeah.
The governor's in charge of the executive branch. So just like the president is in charge of the executive branch. Same formula, just, you know, mm-hmm. in a smaller fashion. But he does have a lot of ability there. If they start passing, you know, different laws, and the difficulty is they pass laws, he can refuse to sign them, but with a two-thirds majority, they get to override that, in, I believe, most cases. So we're in kind of a bind, but that one change would certainly signal a more aggressive will of the people than we're seeing right now, because right now people are running around like chickens with their heads cut off, and there isn't really a united voice. We have to take a really quick break.
Okay.
And I thought the song Upside Down was fitting. I thought it was fitting 10 minutes ago, and I'm still good with it. So let's go there. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Who's to say I can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I'll find with everyone.
Winter getting colder, summer getting warmer. Tidal wave come across the Mexican border. Wide back gal in is cheaper by the barrel. Just don't get busted singing Christmas carols. That's us, that's right. Gotta love this American ride. Both ends of the ozone burning. Funny how the world keeps turning. Look, Ma, no hands. I love this American.
It's funny. My mom, I'm sure, never heard a Toby Keith song, but she would have liked him. he sings about all the stuff that she thought was important.
Yes.
Although she always voted the wrong way, but yeah, blame that on the Contra Costa Times. I lay that squarely at their doorstep. But yeah, I mean, what I was. I was just a little under 2 years old, and I was, I could say, the Pledge of Allegiance. So what was my mom doing with me as a toddler, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We practiced the Pledge of Allegiance every single day. Yeah, she's a good patriot. So, Mike, what are you hearing from guys that, like, you used to work with in the industry? Besides the fact that the price of U-Hauls is expensive leaving the state.
Well, they're, I mean, you know, some of them got decent transfers, but a lot of people got hosed, especially at Valero because they're non-union. So there wasn't any guarantee for anything there. A lot of people did get transfers. It's really, I'm kind of mixed on it. You know, I was writing my paper on the refinery, you know, and the turnarounds, and towards the end, I wrote a really scathing paragraph, and then Katie, kind of working with Katie Grimes, and she kind of tempered it a little. She wanted it to be informational because I was just thinking about Valero and just everything the state's done and how many people's lives are affected, how many people's lives are destroyed. And you go through this, the whole history with this state, with this governor, with this air board. You look at the whole shebang, the immigration, the Palisades, the high speed joke. I mean, it's not even funny. And then what they've done with the refineries, and what people don't realize is if we lose these other six refineries, you're losing 24 to 26 million gallons a day of gasoline production. Somewhere around 12 to 14 million gallons a day of jet fuel and diesel production. We can't make that up. That can't be made up. And people, you know, they need to put their critical thinking cap back on. Take a look at the situation right now, okay? Now, you get a lot of BS reporting from the drive-bys. This Chico station here, you know, they reported on my town hall, and then they did a report, and they said, well, the governor said, you know, they said, well, we're taking care of this. You know, we signed a law, so the refineries have to hold up their fuel, you know, extra fuel storage, which was exactly why Wilmington and Valero shut down. So, you know, they don't analyze anything anymore. Journalism, you know, it's like in a lot of places, it's absolutely dead. You know, you think they would go, well, you know, the governor's office is saying this, Mike or Professor or Stan, what do you think of that? No, they just report it, and it's absolutely wrong. It's patently false. It was patently a lie. And unfortunately, people get, you know, they hear a lot of this stuff because it's being fed to them. But we're on our way, right now we're on our way to a disaster. This looming disaster right now, like the professor in his own words, you know, crisis, the disaster in the making. And if we lose those six refineries, that's it. Everything, the state cannot get that kind of fuel imported. I don't think there's any place in the world that can make that amount of fuel and get it to us. We will be dead in the water. The Port of Los Angeles will close down. The largest food import into our country is through L.A. It'll go down. No logistics, you know, diesel, truck transportation, food in grocery stores, not just the, you know, goods that we use, but, you know, literally food. Our food will, you know, the biggest solid agricultural areas in the world, and we won't have food in our grocery stores. I mean, this is what we're potentially looking at. And they've been, you know, people need to take a look now. Look, they've been saying, they keep saying, oh, I have nothing to see here. There's nothing to see here. Okay, well, prices are going up. There's nothing to see here. And now, hold on, now they're actually starting to report, oh, we could be running into supply shortages now. But for how long have they been saying there's nothing to see here? And it's like they, it's like Governor, our wonderful governor, you know, he was, about 3 months ago, was saying that the military readiness, force readiness report that we published was not accurate and it was fear-mongering. But if you looked at the documents, the three letters that the oil corporation submitted to the state, two of those companies, Chevron's one of them, they submit our document, reference it as one of the documents that they were writing their letter to them, you know, to the state, saying, well, we were looking at this document here. This is all correct. It's like why Andy Waltz back in September said, I think we're already at that crisis mode. And he said a number of times, the state needs to declare a state of emergency. He's actually said that, you know, which is actually spot on correct. So, there, you know, that's one of the things I see, biggest things I see nowadays is people have lost their ability, just the critical thinking. Folks, you need to look and go, why have these prices gone up? Well, we told us. We were told there's nothing to look at. Now they're talking shortages. They're actually reporting it now. What's going on here?
Yeah.
Well, you can't, we have, what is it, 14 days of fuel stored? Is that right? Or we're supposed to?
That
or
was
something?
Yeah, he would. Well, it's back in the professor. I've learned so much working with him and Stan, too. You know, the three of us have learned a lot of stuff working with each other. It's one heck of a team between the three of us. But the, I think, 14 days. And typically when we reach 12 days, that's kind of a starting to hit like a yellow alert on Star Trek, you know, where the price jumps up at about a dollar a gallon. But last thing I heard was we're somewhere around 7 or 8 days.
Wow.
Of supply.
That's not, and that's the thing not is, much of a margin.
Well, that's the thing. It's the margin, the cushion's pretty much gone. And in that document that Professor Miché submitted with Professor Rector, he said he was saying that once the supply shock hits and these tankers stop coming, then we're going to start reducing our in-state inventories at something like 10 to 20% a week. So we're probably already there first or second week. So our, you know, it's not good. And again, it's to the point where even the drive-by media now is starting to report it. And now Democrats are also, there's Democrats are standing up because their constituents, you know, they've been saying there's nothing to look at here, there's nothing to look at. Well, now all of their constituents, they're not unlike us in the fact that they're paying, they're seeing the price go way up, $7-$8 a gallon, they're paying through the nose. And they're, you know, a lot of their constituents are going, hey, look, you were saying that nothing's going to happen here. There's nothing to look at. I just spent $200 filling my tank. What the heck's going on? What's wrong with you? Why aren't you doing your job? So I think what's going on with some of the Democrats in our state now, even in the assembly, they're starting to feel the pushback from their own constituents, just saying, hey, you know, what are you doing to us?
Well, the hard part is once it hits the pumps, I mean, once you start with the shortage, it isn't a warning signal. I mean,
no, it's there. It's
that's
on us.
End of the road.
Yeah.
What about the jet?
Yeah, that's. Mm. What's that? I'm sorry.
I was going to say, what about the jet fuel? We don't hit that enough. And honestly, between the military readiness with jet fuel and. Well, the fact that we have international airports.
Yeah, but all these commercial airports, they need a lot of fuel.
Yeah, you got
people. Well, and they've been raising the rates big time, and they've been starting to, last 2 or 3 weeks, starting to cancel flights. That's constantly reported now in the media. That's going on. When we heard April 2nd that South Korea was shutting off the jet fuel, they're our biggest jet fuel supplier in Asia. So they shut that off. I know that some jet fuel is being moved from SoCal up to NorCal. So I think things are extremely tight. I've heard the price of jet fuel at minimum has doubled. I've heard other, reports where the price of jet fuel has tripled. And yes, we're right on the edge. We lose, especially right now, if we lose another refinery, if one goes down, we're in deep kimchi. I mean, mm-hmm. we're teetering on the edge, and it's like the supply shock hasn't totally hit. Those ships coming across the ocean, now they're pretty much gone. So that all of that fuel that was coming to us is no more. So the refineries, and then when the refineries, the ones that we have left online, the seven, when we need them to run at max rates, they're having to cut back because they were bringing in 30% of their crude oil from the Middle East. Remember that report like 4 or 5 days ago, the last crude oil shipment from the Middle East arrived down in Long Beach? Well, I'm sure they're sourcing, trying to source other crude oil supplies. I don't have enough knowledge on knowing. I mean, that's what I would be doing. But the last thing I heard was all the refineries are cut back. So you need them right now at max rates, but they're actually cut back. So it's kind of a snowball effect. Dominance, which we used to be, to dependence, which we are at now.
As far as jet fuel goes, you can't truck enough of that into the state to make a difference because we don't have enough tankers, do we?
That's correct. You know, you have the infrastructure, load, offload, it just doesn't exist. Yeah. California was never designed to do any of that stuff because California always took care of itself. That's how it got the fourth largest. What's the professor always say? 8% of the GDP, the other 92%.
You know? Yeah, 8% is oil and gas, and without it, yeah, the other 92 doesn't materialize.
That doesn't happen, and they never. Our state has never had to worry about that 8%. We've always taken care of ourselves. This is the thing, and you got the old governor who said, "Oh yeah, we're the fourth or fifth largest economy in the world." Oh, that's true. Okay, well, there's a reason why we got there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a reason why we got there, and it wasn't you, Governor Newsom. You did not make this happen. You're destroying it. You're killing people. You're killing the industries. Every industry, ag, apricots, peaches, all those, you know, canneries shutting down, Budweiser, Yamaha, all these companies leaving. And it's all for the same thing, the cap and invest. If you're running a border, remember Stan was explaining it last week on the cap and invest. If you're running a border, you're getting tapped on the cap and invest just like the oil refineries are. Where you driving one company. I mean, I remember that Budweiser plant was built in Fairfield back in like 75 or 6, and it's been fine. It's kind of a little shining star there while you're driving down Interstate 80. Now it's shut down. Just pretty much the same reason that Valero went down. Now that fourth or fifth largest economy in the state was because of our dominant energy industry. And now it is big time in jeopardy.
Didn't they just invest in a big windmill to help subsidize the cost of energy for that plant?
They did that a while ago, Bill. That's been there for a while, but yeah. Well, you got the trade winds that come in off the bay, over the hills, over America Canyon, and over Benicia. That's what I keep hearing. Well, the refinery was causing asthma. Well, no, the winds that are blowing always cause asthma. I got it all the way into Vacaville. You said the refinery causing asthma in Vacaville?
I always love the things that as someone who has asthma and has for 65 years, I always find it amusing, the things that cause asthma.
Well, it's when you're going down 680, you get off the Interstate 80, yeah, you head towards Benicia and cross over to Martinez to Concord. When you go down 680, the trees grow at about a 60-degree angle.
Yeah, right.
Towards the valley, because the winds are constantly blowing hard.
I don't think I've ever been through that Benicia area where the wind wasn't trying to blow you off the road.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And, you know, I was looking under the air quality index, I think it was 2024. The Solano County didn't have one single unhealthy day. In the whole county, there wasn't even one, there wasn't one single unhealthy day. Because the air stays clean, the air all stays clean there, it all stays clean there, that refinery. Whatever it admitted, and believe me, that's the other thing too, is I controlled those, multiple units that you don't control normally in one refinery. I controlled multiple units, and a lot of those were the ones that controlled the emissions that were going to the air. We were such, back when I ran that thing, the requirements were so strict back then. We emitted very, very little to the atmosphere at any time. Very little. And, you know, like they were going to run some of the more sour, heavy crude. They'd want to increase the rates, and I would be in the refinery, the management meeting with the refinery manager and the operations manager. And I was one of the best, if not the best, at dialing that refinery in as hard as I could to make the most amount of profit that we could. But, you know, when I tell them, they'd say, well, can we pick up the other continental shelf, which is the oil they just restarted? You know, can we pick that up another 500 barrels? And I'd look right back at them and say, no, I got it pushing as hard as we can go right now. I wouldn't go anymore. And there would be no pushback. You know, they wouldn't try to push those limits.
Hold that thought, Mike.
Hold everything where it is.
We have to come back and talk about that some more. But the news is going to preempt us. We'll be right back. Right. Our guest is Mike Ariza. We are chatting about the oil and gas issue here in California and actually what's kind of behind it. You can find more at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
I'm not even going to give Bill a bad time this hour.
No, you shouldn't.
I got it all out of my system last hour.
Thank you very much.
Mike, it's your turn. Oh, sorry. No, I didn't mean that. So it's Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms. We're here working diligently to bring you information on Mother's Day. I'd like to say because we have no lives, but we seem to be busy. So I guess we do have lives. All right. Mr. Ariza is our hostage for the second hour again. We're talking about the gas thing. You can get to the information about this. I made us a shortcut. You can go through gascrisis.org, and that'll take you directly to the page that curates all of the stuff on this issue. So we have 9 different shows, so you can listen to those. They're free to listen to, free to send to people. You can post them on Facebook, all sorts of stuff. We make it easy and free. On there are the letters from 3 of the refineries that have come out this year. So 2 from PBF, 2 from Marathon, 2 from Chevron. They own 2 refineries each. So 1 letter from each company and what they intend to do, which is close if the California Air Resources Board doesn't figure it out. And just for easy math, that would be 6 of the 7 refineries in the state of California. Oops, worth reading the letters. There is also a 2-page paper on there written by Professor Michael Miché, who we have had on the show multiple times, and also Professor James Rector out of Berkeley. It's called California Gasoline Supply Outlook, A Disaster in the Making, dated April 15th, 2026. Worth a read. It's 2 pages, 1.75 pages, easy read, and it should give you a real heads up in case you were thinking that this wasn't actually a problem. I dare you to read that and think it's not a problem. There's also like an 8-page, it's labeled as comprehensive analysis, and that has been used multiple times and is cited by all of the companies who wrote to the California Air Resources Board requesting they change their policy so they could continue to operate and provide gas, diesel, jet fuel, propane, all the good stuff that
we use every day.
Makes us not cavemen. So
for all those folks out there that think these high gas prices are all going to go away as soon as this Iran war is over, what do you say to them, Mike?
Shazam.
I hear it all the time. Oh, this is all Trump's
it's
fault.
It's all Trump's fault.
This war is driving gas prices up, and it has a small effect on that, but prices aren't going to go down when this war is over, are they?
Had we utilized the resources in our own state, we would have been affected 0%.
Been isolated.
Wouldn't that have been a good idea?
Well, and now there's two things to look at, too, to that effect. First of all, the prices started going up and Valero went down. And then continue to go up. We've gone up quite a bit more in the rest of the country. So you look at that right there. And then the other thing is, there's no place in the country that's talking about shortages.
Right.
Even our drive-by media here in California is starting to talk about shortages. There's no place in the country talking about shortages.
Right.
So when this war does end, when the strait opens back up, the rest of the country is going to go back because of Venezuela and other things. I agree with a lot of these analysts that say we're probably going to have a crude oil glut. So crude oil prices are going to drop, and gasoline prices could very well be lower than they've ever been in years and years and years in the rest of the country. But no, California, because at minimum, you got to fill up the crude oil tankers, start going through Hormuz. They got to go to Asia. They got to get those tanks, crude oil tanks, back up to a sufficient level. Then they raise their rates. Then they have to bring, the refineries will raise their rates. Then they have to get their product tanks, gasoline, jet, and diesel, up to reasonable levels. And that's got to be stable. Then they'll start the fuels tankers coming to us again. Right there, you're looking at a month. Travel time across the Pacific, you're looking at a minimum of 35 days to 45 days. So if we're lucky, 2.5 months, maybe even 3 months, probably pushing it well into the summer.
And then I hear people say, oh, we'll get all this oil from Venezuela, and that'll solve the problem. Talk to us about the difference between that oil and the oil we get overseas, and why we can't use it.
I think some of that oil we actually can use just to reduce rates, you know, because like with Valero, we had a cut of Alaskan North Slope. We would run the Outer Continental Shelf, which is three platforms are restarted, and then we would run San Joaquin Valley crude. We would run a mixture of crude, so you probably run a decent amount of it. You just can't run up and match rates depending on the actual.
Well, isn't the Venezuela oil much thicker oil, and they have to make changes to all the refineries to use it?
It's heavier. Well, no, the heavier oil is actually what the heavier sour oil is most of the refiners were designed to run in the States, so that would go fine. The thing is, you're looking at the crude oil. That does not affect the products. That doesn't affect the refineries that are down. Will it help us? Of course. We should be producing our own. Will it help us? Yeah, it'll help stabilize our crude supply. But they actually help the state out in the grand scheme of things? No, not very much. We need to be producing our own. That would help us.
And have the ability to refine it.
Yes, that's the big.
That's the biggie.
So before we leave the idea of this, we talk about it a lot, the states, the program that is driving this, the catalyst for this whole nonsense of not utilizing our own resources, it has been cap and trade. So the idea that we would stop producing CO2, it's the whole global hysteria. So I just did a little search during the break, and just put in California cap and invest instead of cap and trade. They tried to doll it up by calling it cap and invest because, you know, it's
climate change, not global warming.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So here's the short description. California's cap and invest program, formerly cap and trade, is a key policy extended to 2045 via Assembly Bill 1207, designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 40% below 1990 levels. Not sure what was going on in 1990 that was so bad, but they're going to do that by 2030 and achieve net zero by 2045. So apparently all the plants will be dead because they use CO2, so we're going to have zero CO2 over the state of California, but the rest of the world is going to have it, just not here. We're not going to have it here. Right. So that makes no sense. It covers roughly 80% of the state's emissions by setting a declining limit on major polluters, provided that you think CO2 is pollution, using auction proceeds to fund climate projects. That sounds super legit. That actually sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit for, like, smart people.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, legit projects like the high-speed rail, that's one of the big ones. Yeah.
Well, and so we learned a really long time ago from Leland Seward. Ha! That was in my Wayback Machine. Leland Seward, that was like, I want to say 14 years ago. And he was a climate guy. And he said, so for all those people that tell you that CO2 is a pollutant, I want you to just, first of all, you confirm that with them. So you think CO2 is a pollutant? Yes.
Deadly,
yes, it is.
Deadly
pollutant, too, yes. You know, for that matter. He said, so did you know that CO2 is about 400 parts per million in the air that you currently breathe? But if you were to go down for some reason and you needed CPR and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, that breathing into someone is 10,000 parts per million, or 40,000 parts per million. The math was easy, and I bungled it. So we go from 400 parts per million that we're breathing in real time to 40,000 parts per million breathed into you, which should make you...
dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except for...
right.
Except for it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's confusing.
How's that work? You're breathing poison into them.
And I just want you to know I have asked the climate alarmists this many, many times, too many to actually count. And every time I ask them why that is, why is that, that 10,000 parts per million breathed into another person doesn't make them die? And then they look at me. I'm not sure if the math is confusing or I'm not sure what it is, but they always look at me like quizzically and hoping I'll get another idea and
because
not make them answer.
Because you're a troublemaker.
I am a troublemaker. And then they tell me
you're a contrary.
It's different.
Yeah.
That's the answer. It's different. That's why you don't die.
It's a different kind of CO2.
It's a different CO2.
It's a different CO2. That's right.
Yeah.
Because that's the way elements work. You know, you have the periodic table and then you have the other periodic table and you have a different periodic table because... you know, if you put it on the different periodic table, the C and the O and stuff,
yeah,
they're
yeah.
different.
Totally different.
Uh-oh. We just disconnected. Mike's head just exploded.
Yeah, he hung up. So hopefully I'll call him back.
Oh, he's probably driving. He is driving. There's Mike. He's like, whoops. He went through the cone
of... oh, he's driving. He's breathing. Driving. He's breathing much more CO2.
He went through the cone of silence.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, anyway. Did you go through the cone of silence?
I went through somewhere. well, the funny thing is that unit that they find Valero, the hydrogen generation unit, it makes hydrogen and CO2. That's what it makes.
Yeah.
One of the units, they recover the CO2 and it goes over to liquid carbonics, which ends up in, you know, our drinks and different things. And the other unit, they just vent the CO2 to the atmosphere. So, yeah, that's why, and every refinery has these, and it has multiple of them most of the time, because they have to have hydrogen for the process, you know, the ultra-low sulfur hydro-deurethanization units and all the other units that require hydrogen, hydro-treating units, well, they need hydrogen, so the refinery generates it, and in the process, you also make carbon dioxide. So that's, you know, one of them at Valero vented to the atmosphere. The other one, they recovered the carbon dioxide, sent it over liquid carbonics. So, you know, that was, Valero knew, the corporation knew that was their bottom line, was it's CO2. It's that pollutes CO2, and that's why. You know, they said, there's carcinogens, there's reproductive harm agents. Well, let's look at the big picture. In 50-something years, Benicia's never had a cancer problem. Never had a reproductive harm problem, nor has the industrial park, nor have the employees in the refinery, but they're emitting all this cancer, you know, and if you knew there were, and we both know, if there were cancer problems in Benicia, we would hear about it until the cows come home, you know, until we couldn't stand it anymore. So, well, they're doing this and that. No, it was all about the CO2, and that's why you can't run a hydrogen generation unit, you can't run a refinery.
It's inexplicable.
It's flawed science.
Considering CO2 makes plants grow, and if you have a greenhouse, they pump CO2 into greenhouses to make plants grow. So,
that's what we learned.
Yeah, yep. Right.
That's what we learned back in school.
Didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah, back in the prehistoric age when everything was green and we had huge plant life. CO2 is much, much higher than it is now.
Yeah.
I don't even think we can get it that high anymore.
So,
yeah.
At the end of the...
when we were growing...
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
I don't know.
You're in a bad spot.
You guys
Mike.
There?
Yeah, there we are.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get to work. Okay. Yeah, you look back at it, the air in the 70s sucked. I mean, it really did, you know, and even going to the 80s, but we made so many drastic improvements. By the time we hit the 90s, like they're talking about, unless we're having a big forest fire, the air is a heck of a lot better, much, much better than it was before. So a lot of things were accomplished. You know, we were on ultra low sulfur diesel and ultra low sulfur gasoline when I was running it. you know, so a lot of these things did take care of the air. But now it's like you said, you get that, that other 1% is going to collapse your entire economy, and they don't care, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a control mechanism. So let's take a really quick break. I've got some great medical. I have medical advice this break. I decided to go with some.
Oh, we all like that.
Yep, medical advice, sound medical advice.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.usmd.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for a diamond. Sister hiding out a one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, "Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take?" I said, "Doctor, to relieve this bellyache." I said, "Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take?" I said, "Doctor."
I like my steak well done, potatoes fried, football games on Monday night. It's just who I am, a meat and potato man. I like my coffee black, old TV shows, my women hot and my beer ice cold. It's just who I am, a meat and potato man.
Sounds like he had a good mom. I'm going at this Mother's Day thing through the back door here. Play all the man songs.
Copy that.
Yeah, so, you know, we can go to the doctor and they can put the lime in the coconut, but I, you know, so I don't think that's good medical advice. It is fun, though, and it's a snappy song. But getting rid of all the CO2 so that we can, I don't know, say that we did it or something and make all our plants die. I don't think that's super smart. And kill our industry and make everyone poor.
Yeah. Well, and literally starve everyone to death.
Oh, there's that.
Where that's heading if all the refineries shut down, yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that part. Sorry. No more meat and potatoes,
yeah,
man.
You got to remember that part. It's like some of these.
Uh-oh.
Oh, that was it.
Oh, mic's out.
Hold on.
So I'm looking at the two-pager, and I want to look at the solution. Mike's already read it, so when he gets back on, then he'll figure it out. But it says here, the only available near-term mitigation lever is to expand the pool of gasoline supply that can be accessed. That can be achieved by temporarily relaxing California's low-carbon fuel standard and allowing gasoline used in other parts of the country to be used in this state. Huh, what a great idea. However, since California has no inbound pipelines, the action will not result in additional gasoline at the pump until mid-May, unless more drastic measures such as rail or truck transportation is used. To replace a major pipeline such as the San Pablo Bay Crimson Line would require as many as, yep, you guessed it, 760 tanker trucks per day. Assuming equivalent volumes. Yeah, we thought, well, you were in the cone of silence. We thought we'd spoiler alert the solution. But see, this solution is from April 15th, nearly a month ago. So that whole idea that won't result in additional gasoline at the pump until mid-May, that was if they would have made a change back in the middle of April. But they didn't.
They did.
Yes.
The silence. But just pause a moment to just let that sink in, folks. So then, accordingly, it says here, it is our opinion, so the two professors, and based on current public data, that California may experience gasoline shortages persisting well into June unless the low-carbon fuel standard is temporarily relaxed April 15th. In the time travel machine. Correspondingly, retail gasoline prices are expected to increase due to supply and sourcing issues, as well as regulatory costs, which routinely add to the price of gasoline on July 1st every single year. to address the imminency of the situation, the California legislature should consider, but didn't, suspension or revocation of the California special blend gasoline in favor of the national reformulated standard. I mean, honestly, switching to the same gas everyone uses all around the entire country.
Yeah, they're not complaining about
it. That's a no-brainer.
It is just a no-brainer, which is why our gas prices are always higher than anyone in the country.
Yes, that is correct. And the state of Washington's catching up with us.
In stupidity?
Washington, they're putting in the same policies.
Right. Yeah, their stupidness is... Yeah, their stupidness is catching up with our stupidness.
Now, is Washington going to go to a special blend?
They're on their way there. They're on their way there. They haven't quite hit it yet, but they got a lot of the same. They're employing a lot of the same regulations that we're using with cap and trade. I would be surprised if they try to go to a special blend, but yeah, you would think they would look at us and go, that's not such a great idea.
This is a terrible plan. Wow. Isn't it amazing? We're not learners right now. We're in that phase of civilization where I guess we just don't learn.
Yeah, well, here in California we are. Like, wow.
So from a pollution standpoint, I know we've talked about this a little bit, but I seem to remember way back at the beginning of this discussion, like in December when we first started chatting with you guys, that all of this nonsense resulted in less than 1%, like cleaner air or something. What was the deal with that?
Reduction in pollutants, yes. Or what they consider to be pollutants, because like you were just making the big point about CO2. Mm-hmm. They consider CO2 to be a pollutant, and it's like, no, it's not.
Yeah, no, it makes plants grow. And so for that, that's why we're going through all this. A less than one.
Yes.
So all right, you used to, run the refinery, not by yourself, but, used to run the refinery. Uh-huh. So... could you even tell? I mean, would anybody even be able to tell?
1%? I doubt it.
Yeah.
No, you could, yeah.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. In the 70s, we could tell. I mean, the 70s, it was bad, and going in the 80s, it was still bad. But we've improved so much. Air quality has improved so much. Like I said, unless there's a fire, the overall air quality is phenomenally better than it used to be. So we have achieved a lot of, improvement. And when you think about it, Aaron, Bill, if we hadn't changed anything, the amount of cars we have on now, I mean, it would be terrible. So, our engine efficiencies have gone up, even the diesel trucks, the technology, changing diesel specs, diesel, like the hydro de-optimization of diesel, different things like that. It has improved. It's definitely improved. And we've done good to that accord, but now we've gone so far over the cliff, it's not even funny. With all the other things that we've already talked about, and to the point where you got three major corporations saying, "Hey, dude, you just sit down and talk to us, or we're probably going to shut down and leave." That says it all right there, as far as I'm concerned.
So to make the switch, okay, so you're running the refinery, and now they're going to allow you to have, the same kind of gas that everybody else has. How, what do you have to do? What happens?
There's not a lot. You just don't blend as much alkylate, and you can use less of the alkylate, which is the higher octane. It's low olefin, real world sulfur, high octane blending component. Within our state, it's actually, since they're already doing it, you can drop the summer blend. That would be a big help. But we're already making our carb gas. There isn't a, to my understanding, is there's not really much they would do different. They can still make it. It's not going to increase any real significant volumes for us not to make it here, but it would allow other people that make it that's not Car Bob to bring their significant volumes to us. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at it, 100% gasoline production, the total volume, it might increase like by 3%, 2%, something like that. Maybe. It may not affect it at all, but it would allow us to start bringing fuel in here that was not, it's the regular federal blend.
Right. Now, where would that fuel come from?
Well, probably stuff like the Gulf Coast. That would be the biggest one. But I don't know what all their numbers are as far as how I know that refineries are already maxed out. I know at Chalmette, New Orleans, they just had a fire. PBF had a fire on their reformer unit, so that one's partially down. But to make up the volumes that we're talking about, I'm not sure.
The fuel they're manufacturing there now is all being used. It's all, I guess, spoken
for. That's
the
thing.
So
that's the thing, yes.
What, are we going to short everybody else so California can have more?
And no, they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that.
No.
And if they have extra fuel you got a European market or something like that, and they're going to pay you more, they're sending it there.
Right, right.
That's why California just really left itself flailing in the wind. From every aspect, from economics, the whole nine yards. We just really left ourselves so vulnerable and our military so exposed. And you're exactly right. If all their fuel is already spoken for.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, California.
Yeah, it's just the obvious solution is, I think, the only solution. But they don't want to acknowledge it. I mean, they think, I guess this is all going to work itself out magically, and all we have to do is just stay the course. I don't see that happening.
Yeah, no. What are you hearing from? You've been talking to some of the other producers. Like, I know we were on a conference call with Ken the other day. So the guys that you're talking about that are moving oil and gas around, I mean, that's their job. We were hoping to have them on today, but yeah, it was Mother's Day.
Yeah.
What can you kind of summarize what they're telling you?
Shortages. They're starting to have problems. He told me specifically the same thing I've been telling some of the farmers that I deal with is, I know the price is expensive right now, but if you need some or you think you're going to need some, you should probably go ahead and stock up on it now, because he is also foreseeing problems with being able to get fuel, even diesel. He's foreseeing problems with being able to get diesel supply problems. So.
As a distributor, he's a fuel distributor.
As a distributor.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. I'm just seeing it because I know what the rates are of those refineries. I know what got cut back. I know what's been lost. You know, I take Valero. I know the exact numbers of Valero and other refineries. I can, if you're guessing jet fuel within a couple of hundred barrels, like 500 barrels a day, I can pretty much guesstimate with an educated perspective on pretty much what every refinery is doing. It's like I know if we lose these other six refineries, it's 1.2 million barrels a day going offline of crude oil production, which is 42 times that. And if you multiply that by 0.5, it comes out to about 24 to 25 million gallons of gasoline a day production that's gone. Jet fuel, diesel, the numbers are tremendous. That's the thing. That's the part that literally scares me. We cannot make that up. There's no way we can't make that up.
No.
And the situation our state's going to go into, the economical collapse we're going to see.
Yeah, and they know how much fuel is consumed daily in this state. You know, let's just say gasoline.
Yeah, last number I heard was 36 million. Last number I heard was about 36 million, Bill.
Yeah. So they have to be able to make that shortfall up. And if they don't, I mean, the outcome is pretty obvious. But they don't want to look at that. That's what just kind of blows my mind.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of these numbers. I know what these refineries do. And, yeah, that's the part. I totally agree with you. That's the part that blows my mind, too. It's like, why are you guys not seeing this? And, you know, I've gone on different, you know, like podcasts with, like, a retired Brigadier General Holt from the Air Force who flew the C-17 KC-135, and he was, like, a logistician, logistics guy at NATO. And it's like he was saying, you know, cities have 3 to 4 days of 5 days of food supply tops. And if you take away the diesel or severely cut the diesel fuel back, then you're not going to get transports. You're not going to have the Port of Los Angeles running. You're not going to be able to move food around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'll survive up where we're at for a while, but people that live in all the metropolitan areas, they're looking at real problems with food. It's like, you know, you can have all the money in the world. You want to stock a celery and you go to the store and it's not there, you're not going to get it. Or milk or anything else that's not there. And then some of these folks with the big houses, they're going to look like grocery stores to the mobs.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah, and then we'll be sad that we converted our farmland to solar panels.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they're busy taking water away from our farmers. Now, you know, we're going to need those folks. We have concentrated them in some areas, and so much of our product is trucked. I mean, when I was a kid, we lived in the East Coast. We ate all of our vegetables, really, basically came out of a can. Everything came out of a can. You know, they don't grow vegetables there, and we didn't really have the transport situated to have big produce sections there. And then there's always the factor that it was probably quite expensive, and we had 5 kids. So there was that. But hence the fact I never had a fresh mushroom till I moved to California and went to college. Where I had a roommate who told me upon entering my dorm that she didn't ever eat foods that squeaked. And I was like, I don't know of any foods that squeak. She said mushrooms, and I'm thinking about the mushrooms in a can. Well, hot tip, they don't squeak. I ate a real one, and by Jove, they squeaked. So, on that happy note, let's take a really quick break because teed up the Farmer's Almanac. I thought it might be fun. Play something fun, right, with all our bad news bears. Something fun. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
A sweet old lady was 84 when her kin folks came for a month or more. Now from overwork, she's on the other shore. Much too late was y'all come back. And it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, visitors and fish smell after 3 days. Our leader was a silver-tongued man. He deceived the people of the land. And when he got caught, he couldn't stand. It's a little offbeat and a little off track. But it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, in rivers and bad government, the lightest things float to the top.
Now don't talk to me about the polar bear. Don't talk to me about the ozone layer. Ain't so much of anything these days, even the air. You're running out of rhinos, what do I care? Let's hear it for the dolphin. Let's hear it for the trees. Ain't running out of nothing in my deep freeze. It's casual entertainment.
Environmental song. Never gets old. It running out of nothing in my deep freeze. So Mike, you know, when you talk to somebody, you know, you're doing the same thing I'm doing. This is like, here, you know, you should look all this stuff up. Do you know what's going on? what do people typically, what's their initial response? Do they believe you?
No, not all of them. I'd say a lot of them don't. They just, despite the fact of what's going on around them in front of their very eyes, no, they don't. Some do. Some will listen. You know, I'll give out one of the cards, talk to them. Some of them I'll even show them, here, just look that up. You know, you want to find out what's really going on. You know, this is the domain here, you know, and I'll tell them it's me and Professor and Stanley, you know, and Stanley. I'll let you know, all combined working on this. And, yeah, sometimes it's very frustrating. I was pulling up, you were asking about Valero.
Yeah.
You know, this is also why it's frustrating, is a guy named Rob I used to work with, he just messaged me, not right now, but a little while before, but, you know, he says, my true feelings for Benicia were that we all, whether we were Exxon or Valero, because me and Rob hired on in 90 together when it was Exxon, but he said, whether Exxon or Valero, we all had strong ethical strengths and absolutely the best training for everyone was given. Anyone who left our site, they were superstars at any other facility that they went to. We valued our training department and ensured that our folks checked every single box and became highly qualified operators.
Well, they're
so that slowly, is a lot of frustration.
Yeah, they're going away to other plants, and chances are,
well, they're gone. Yeah, they're gone. They're gone. Back. A lot of them left like 3 months ago. Yeah, I got a couple of my buddies I talked to said, yeah, well, if we could really. You know, the professor's executive orders number 6 was to reanimate Benicia. You know, and they told me if that really happened, there's a couple of the guys says I'll come. One's in retirement, about my actually a couple years younger than me. And you know, he said I'll come back. He says Mike, that happens. If you get involved, we'll come back. So you know, but still going to be way short of the people you need, man, especially in the control room. Hmm. That's where you run into trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't have unqualified people or undertrained people in an operation like that and not have a catastrophe. I mean, that's the thing
that people don't understand. I know you got it and Aaron's got it. You got to have experience. You got to be trained, but you got to have time behind, you know, especially that control room. It was like almost three years before you were fully considered qualified. And that was, you already had 3 units outside. You were qualified on at least a minimum of 3 units out the field. And then you, came in the control room and you trained, and if your boss was good, he sent you to other field classes. Mine was, he sent me to all 8 of the ones that we control. But this is years of experience and seeing things. You know, there's so many things I dealt with and fixed, and sometimes you had 10 or 15 seconds to make million-dollar decisions. One time I shut down a piece of equipment. The seal was bad. It was leaking hydrogen sulfide out of these seals. And the rotating equipment folks had looked at it a couple times, and the operator, Daryl, he calls me out there, calls me at the control room, and says, Mike, these seals are getting pretty bad here. You know, so that it's kind of funny. The rotating equipment supervisor was in there at the same time in the control room, and I go, is that you, Daryl? Well, Dale Cross, the guy, the supervisor, he said, well, they're going to send a couple guys to look at it. What do you think, Daryl? And he says, I don't know, Mike. It's getting pretty bad. I go, okay, are you upwind of it? Okay. Then I call up the crude unit guy to go over to a couple chain valves he was going to need to go to. And I got up, I walked right around. That guy said, excuse me. I went to the back panel. Okay. I go, C601 coming down. I tripped the compressor offline. I shut the isolation valves. I depressured that part of the unit to the flare. And, I walked back to the supervisor and said, he'll have his your permit ready to work on it in about 30 minutes. And the guy's face was just, he was just like stunned. It's like, no, you're not, you know, that was part of my job, was to make sure that no harm came to the citizens of Benicia or anybody in the plant. And that one decision cost the refinery about $300,000 a day. And, you know, the next day the refinery manager came in there and said, hey, Mike, thanks for shutting that down. Those seals were worse than what the rotating equipment people thought they were. So like, you know, he doesn't want to see something like that either. But that was very rare. But you know, that was your job in there, the safety of everybody in the plant, the whole city of Benicia. I was responsible for that, and I took that responsibility seriously. And the people were trained, the operators were trained to look at these things, evaluate them, and make the decisions. You know, because at nighttime, at nighttime, there's nobody there. The managers aren't there. It's your team. It's your team of operators and shift superintendent running the place. And you all relied on each other. So, and that type of camaraderie, there was a lot of that there. It's all gone. Plant that was the shining star of the state that should be taking care of us right now is offline. And it's offline for no reason other than this governor and his air board.
Well, just out of curiosity, we never really, I think I spoke with you about it on the phone, but we never really discussed the whole deal with what this did to the communities surrounding these plants. So not only are we starving the state for fuel and the military and our airports and all this stuff, but what did that do for their local community?
Well, Benicia lost 15% to 20% of its budget. There's rotating equipment companies that fix the pumps and compressors. They lost all their business. They had to shut down different fitters, manufacturers, welders, a bunch of these different companies that worked. You know, there was a mechanical crew that was contractor mechanical crew that worked in the refinery every day. They're gone. All the collateral damage, businesses, shops, restaurants. Benicia lost at least 15% of its entire budget, maybe 20% of its budget. And then Valero, Exxon, then Valero, they used to take, my dad was the assistant fire chief and an operator technician, but he was assistant fire chief for a while. You know, and dad told me, though, they would take, Benicia firefighters to San Antonio or to Texas A&M, take them to school. Take them to training back to Reno when, we used to all go to Reno fire training when Reno had a training ground. But Exxon and Valero would pay to take their firefighters. They helped them buy good equipment. They would buy Benicia. The city of Benicia itself didn't need, anything more than ambulance and its basic fire engine. Well, Valero, Exxon bought them better, more state-of-the-art equipment and kept them up to date and kept them trained on it. And they would train together. They would work together. They contributed a lot to the schools. There's a lot of collateral things that the refinery did as a partner with the city. It's gone now. And I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor, who was on the air board that got Valero fined. I mean, such a big conflict of interest there. You know, you're on the air board and you're getting the company fined. You really, I hope, they enjoy that little bonus they're getting, because after that, it's gone. And right now, unless the president intervenes and someone, and he give Valero somebody to come back, Benicia, it's gone. They've lost it. It's gone.
Yeah, because they're how much of their budget was going away because of Benicia closing, wasn't it?
Something like 20%.
Yeah, and 20%. I don't know how you make that up. You don't make it up right away. That's a lot.
Well, you look at the Bill. You look at the refinery. I mean, just take a look at it. There's nothing like that in Benicia. Not even close. Even 1,000th of that.
Right.
So it's like you don't have to be an economics major to understand these things. That damn thing shut down. Benicia's hurting now, and it's going to hurt.
Well, meanwhile, what do you do with that whole big facility? I mean,
well, they're turning it into a terminal. They're trying to, they're thinking they're going to get, make it into a terminal. I think they're actually partially using it for a terminal now, but now there's no ships coming, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
Wait, they're turning they're turning it into what?
A terminal. They're basically using the dock to offload products, diesel, gasoline, basically pump from the dock into the product tanks that the refinery has, and then from the refinery product tanks, they pump it out to Kinder Morgan or Brisbane. They pump it out to the distribution pipelines. So they basically offload the tanker through the dock to a product tank, and then once that's offloaded and the product tank's full, then they pump that product tank out to the system and into the state.
But the actual refinery is just sitting there?
Yes.
Okay.
So what is that, like 5% of the operation they're going to keep functioning in another format?
They're keeping wastewater online, the dock, and two of what they call the oil movements posts, which are the tank movements, the tank farms. So a total of something like 5 operators, maybe 6, 7, say 10 operators, and then 3 shifts.
Right.
So,
which is a small fraction of what was there. So, yeah, it'll, it'll have a huge impact.
Wow, that's totally stupid.
Well, it is. It just, I get a little depressed when I think about it. And that was the shining jewel of the state. That refinery was the shining jewel of the state. And I'm not knocking the other ones, because all those ladies and gentlemen, they work their tails off and they keep their units running and keep things up online. But Valero was designed differently. The training was different. From the get-go, when you stepped in the gate, it was different. I've been into the other refineries. It was definitely different.
And different in, like, a high-quality sort of way.
Yes, exactly. A higher quality of training. Well, because you cross-trained on different units that you don't cross-train on in other refineries. That's why, like me, I have an understanding of almost how an entire refinery runs. Pressures, temperatures, levels, flows, the problems, you know, what you can do, what it can't do. You don't get that in another refinery. You got a CAT unit with its own control room with its own operators. You got a crude unit with its own control room with its own operators. In Benicia, the CAT unit, coker, sulfur, fuel gas, MEA, tail gas, a bunch of other subsidiary units were all controlled from one control room. And I was cross-trained. You know, and then all the guys, like my father was cross-trained. Rob, the guy that wrote that, was cross-trained on six of the units on the other complex. So that's where the training was really, it was really phenomenal there. And this was a concept from Exxon all the way back to 1969 when they built the place.
And how different is that? You know, I know you said it's far superior, but what happens in the other ones? You said that the jobs
were more siloed. They bring you in for more time. They bring you in, well, it's just isolated. You got the CAT cracker, it's got its own control room, it's got its own operators, and then these operators have been there 20, 30 years, you know, 30 years. So you come in, they'll start training you in different sections of that one unit, and you'll qualify, and then eventually you'll I can't speak for all of them, but just roughly, you know, maybe after 2 or 3 years, you'll start working in the control room on that CAT cracker.
What does that even mean? You say that all the time, and I just want you to know, since, you know, it's radio and you can't see us, every time you say that, we laugh, but because it's just a funny name, but we have no idea really what you're talking about.
it's your biggest gasoline-making unit in the refinery. It actually circulates a fluid solid. It's like those suspended solid units, the cogens that we were talking about. Oh. This one actually circulates the fluid solid between two vessels, and they bring in the motor oil to stuff that's almost as heavy as like gear oil, and they actually break it on a molecular level and convert it into gasoline, as much gasoline as they can get. It's a whole different school on it, but it's your big gasoline maker. And the refinery, taking the heavier oils and converting them into gasoline components, or converting them into like gas oils that can go on to another unit and be converted into gasoline. So it's your biggest money maker in the whole plant.
It's like it's just its own world, and it's funny because when you drive down there, you drive down there and you go past all that. It's like, I don't know. So, like, it looks like its own giant town.
Yes, it literally is.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you, would it make any sense for them to come back? Obviously, you don't work for Valero. I mean, you don't get to speak for them. But just with what you know about what it would take to spool it up again, what do you think? You think they would even do that?
If they follow a template of the professor's template on that executive order 6 that he drew up, they might very well do it. But you got to, again, what's happening 2 or 3 years down the road, stuff like that, those concerns that you brought up in previous shows. So they have to have reassurance. They got to know they're going to come back and make some money and not be dealing with the same thing 2 or 3 years down the road. The professor's template was for a seven-year contract with Valero, and then all of Valero's production would go to military or go to working with the governor of Nevada, go to Nevada. So Valero would provide for the military and the governor of Nevada, and that basically their product would already be guaranteed to be purchased. So those are incentives. You know, the professor knows the economics and far more than most people in the world. You know, so those, to me, those are incentives that could bring them back. But they got to do it. They got to get it done. The longer it sits, it's not good.
No, any machinery, if it sits unused for any length of time, you've got to replace it. Replace it or repair it, because it does. It degrades.
Exactly.
Yeah, we've seen that in the mill industry. They shut these mills down, and there's no way to restart them. They just sell it off, and it's gone. So,
yeah, once they start selling stuff off on a refinery, like I think they may be doing that down in Wilmington, bringing it back is going to be a bear.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Extremely expensive.
Wow. Yep. So we're kind of on the bubble at this point. This will be the happiest show we do on this topic right now, because we're headed into the darkness on this. So for people who think that the prices are high now and that we've got issues, good luck with that. We do hope that you will go and share this with other people. You can get directly to this information at gascrisis.org. We're looking to do some town halls throughout the state of California to bring this information to people from the experts, Mike and all the other fellers. And we want to thank you. Got to run away. Happy Mother's Day, Mike.
Thanks again. Happy Mother's Day, Aaron. Thank you, Bill. Thank you both.
Yep, you bet.
All right. Again, you can go straight to that page at gascrisis.org, and that takes you to the radio page, too. Welcome to the Twilight Zone. Yep. Hit it, Alex.